Welcome to the Head Ballet Podcast. This is the place to come to hear my guests discuss with me, Paul Abbott, their favourite novelty songs. The funny, the weird, the daft and the outright baffling tunes that have been skipping and dancing around in their heads for years. Everybody loves something that could be considered novel, so why not celebrate it? I'm joined in this episode by the finest sharer of comedy and novelty record content on Twitter, the mysterious character known only as Dame Agnes Guano. If you've ever seen the illustrious Dame Agnes's Twitter feed, which is at Agnes_Guano, then you'll know that they've got a huge collection of records made by British stars of the stage, screen and studio. So who better to have along to discuss the differences between what's novelty and what's comedy? You can also pop along to the blog downstairslounge.wordpress.com for some excellent articles all about all manner of strange and unusual records. As always, I conclude my opening with a plea for sharing, rating and reviewing the podcast if you're enjoying it. The show is still trying to find a foothold to get more listeners, and I'm sure that if you're listening, then you'll know someone else who would like it as well. So tell them. Remember, I've got Spotify and YouTube playlists to accompany the series, and if you want to get hold of me, then look for the username HeadBalletPod on most social media, or email me at headballetpod@gmail.com. Thank you for your support. Now for a nice, relaxing bath. Anyone who's seen your Twitter feed online, which is at Agnes_Guano, will be well aware that you're sort of dedicated to the fine art of sharing pictures and information about comedy, novelty and unusual records. And, I mean, do you just focus on British stuff primarily?
I do. I don't go out of my way to find American stuff, but if I'm in a record shop or a charity shop, I will pick them up if I see them. Things like Spike Jones, City Slickers and Bob Newhart, things like that.
Yeah.
I don't go out of my way to find them. I think it's because I don't know a lot of American comics and comedians. I do have quite a few, but I'm more sort of, I know where I'm going with British comedy and what's out there, what I'm looking for.
Yeah. So how long have you been collecting these sorts of records for then?
Well, I don't know, probably forever, I think. When I was young, my dad had a stereo. He got a new one, which, of course, the new one lives downstairs, and I got the old one in my bedroom. And he was quite happy with his, you know, Eric Clapton records downstairs. But he sort of gave me all of his records that he wasn't that sort of bothered. You know, when you give records to children, they invariably scratch them or, like me, stick them on at 78 just to see what they sound like. So I was left with all of his comedy records, Hancock, lots of sort of comedy novelty records from the 50s and 60s, like The Goons, Bernard Breslau, that sort of thing. And that's kind of what I grew up listening to, my own world, really, where the 1970s didn't really intrude. I was sort of still living in the 1950s and 60s growing up.
So what's your campaign for when you're looking for these things? Are you up to record shops or you're online? Are you doing a mix of both these days? Well, presumably mostly online these days. But
Mostly online. I think the first month of lockdown, I thought, well, when it was really lockdown, and I didn't know if the post office would even deliver. Since then, yes, I'm really annoying the postman at the moment. But he's mad, so, you know,
Fair enough. And I mean, when you go out, do you have a sort of set criteria of stuff you're looking for? Because presumably at one point it was just, I'm buying whatever I find. But do you have your eye out for something particular these days?
It's still pretty much, I think that's the thing with comedy records, is that even I don't know what's out there. And I'm constantly surprised by things I find and things friends post on Twitter. It's never sort of been taken that seriously that someone has catalogued or done a discography or, you know, some article somewhere. I'm trying to do one myself, but it's taken a while. So I'm constantly surprised. And I always check out record shops wherever I go. Even abroad, I'll hunt down record shops. I went on holiday to Prague for a wedding reception about a year or so ago. Left the girlfriend in the hotel and straight off to the record shop, coming back with a German version of Joe Dolce's Shut Up Your Face, you know. So, highlight of Prague for me.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. Of all the places to pick that up. But, you know, who knows? You might be in a record shop in Lisbon and find a rare and exotic edition of something by Bernard Breslau or something. You never know, do you?
Yeah, but what I find with European releases as well, they always did really nice picture sleeves, whereas here it's just sort of plain sleeves. So there's some records that I've got, I think like Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren, probably because of Sophia Loren's popularity abroad, but Scandinavian copies of their records on the singles are just really nice looking at. I think I've posted a few of those up in my time.
Yeah.
Denmark and Norway.
It's fantastic. I mean, so much of your record collection must literally be stars of the 50s and 60s of basically any comedy show on TV. So many of them put out singles and albums, didn't they, alongside their main career?
Well, it was what was sort of expected to do. It was a money spinner, wasn't it? You had your summer season, your panto, cramming a film or a TV series in between those, and this is kind of the money on the side. The days before DVDs were existence, even VHS, or, you know, that was if you saw an act in a film or in a music hall that you liked, the only way of sort of, you know, listening to them or reliving that act was to buy a comedy record.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, of course, as you've got sort of the literal reproductions like the Hancock type ones, but then if you just wanted some more of that star, you might get the single, the sung song, which might be serious, it might be comic, might, you know, whatever, which I suppose leads us a little bit towards what the topic of this podcast is about. Because when we first discussed sort of you coming on the podcast, you sent me quite an interesting message, which basically said what we need to do is debate what's comedy and what's novelty in regards to music. And you selected a couple of songs which you put forward as examples of these two threads. So before we get stuck into the actual debate over that, could you tell everyone at least which artist you've brought along to illustrate the points today?
Well, Charlie Drake. A few of his early songs, like Valare, Splish Splash, kind of more pop, even rock and roll, really, Splish Splash. He just gets sort of more crazy, I think, after Mr. Custer, you know, out and out comedy records after that. So that was just sort of to illustrate my point. But I can think of, you know, many other examples of comedians, comics who've done similar things.
I'm sure you can. But we'll stick with Charlie Drake for the moment then and get some music on the go to explain this. But, I mean, for people who don't know who Charlie Drake is, and I suspect it's quite a lot of people now, because I don't think he's really had the legacy that many of the stars of the 50s and 60s had. It's not quite as well known, except perhaps for one or two essentially kids' songs they've been treated as over the years.
There's so much in the archive, BBC TV, ITV, that never gets repeated. And I do find it disappointing. Even Gold will just endlessly repeat Only Fools and Horses. The BBC will endlessly repeat Dad's Army. They get to the end of the run, then just start at the beginning again. I mean, Ian Lavender must make a fortune out of reruns, but you think of all the great comedians. I mean, with the Hancocks, for instance, they had a real resurgence in sort of 70s into the 80s on Radio 4. And I listen to them all. I mean, Radio 4 Extra now is quite good at that sort of thing. But television-wise, people like Dick Emery, Charlie Drake, their body of work is just never seen. You know, they were really big stars in their day.
And it's very much hidden away in the archive, like you say.
Yeah.
Which is why perhaps if anyone does know Charlie Drake, the thing that they probably will know is My Boomerang Won't Come Back, because it will have been on a kid's compilation that someone in the 60s, 70s, 80s would have had.
Yeah.
And that's his sort of signature song to a lot of people. That's all they'll know him for.
Now tell me, what's your trouble, boy?
My boomerang won't come back.
Your boomerang won't come back.
My boomerang won't come back. My boomerang won't come back. I'll wave the thing all over the place. Practice till I was.
There's someone I know from the pub. She works on the railway, and quite often when she's, well, the days when you could come in late to a pub unannounced and sit down and talk to people. But she really likes My Boomerang Won't Come Back. It's her favourite song. So that used to be a sort of a late night choice at the pub. And I think that's probably from that. Things like Terry Scott with My Brother. which was never a hit. It was sort of the B-side. Was it I Like Birds or something like that? But that got more famous because of endless, you know, the Tony Blackburn requests and things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was Don't Light the Fire Till After Santa's Gone, which was a Christmas record he put out. Of course, the years afterwards, my brother became famous. If they hadn't seen all the things that Terry Scott's done, which is numerous TV shows on his own in the 60s, Hugh and I, things like that, into Terry and June. But yeah, they might just know him from My Brother, which is a good song.
Whose pet mouse made Auntie shriek? Who ate glue and couldn't speak? What clever dick was sick for a week? My brother. Who keeps maggots?
It's a staple of the comedy novelty compilations, really. With Charlie Drake, then, so, I mean, what do we know about Charlie Drake career-wise that we can elucidate for people?
There's that whole generation, really, that started during the Second World War, and Charlie Drake was one of them. I mean, he's only 5'1", but he joined the Air Force, teamed up with Jack Edwards, who was his partner for many years, who was 6'4". So already you've got that sort of physical comedy thing. They auditioned for the Windmill Theatre, which, again, so many comedians of that generation did. But they tried auditioning as singers, and Charlie Drake has a really good voice. I don't know what Jack Edwards' voice was like, but Charlie Drake definitely has a good voice.
Yeah, I agree. There's a certain Cribbins-y quality to it as well, which I quite like. They're in a similar ballpark when they actually get into doing their records with George Martin.
He can really belt it out, though, the tunes on things like Splish Splash. You know, when he's singing, and Valare as well, he can hit the notes. You know, he's not just doing a silly song. And I think with the best will in the world, Cribbins is good at interpreting songs, but I don't remember me hitting many notes.
Well, I don't know. I won't have Hole in the Ground besmirched. But But yes, I'm a big fan of Cribbins. But but I think there's what I'm trying to get at there is there's that sort of actor, performer, entertainer thing. I've got a certain quality. But you are right. I mean, Charlie Drake, for all of his career, which he made, he sort of got quite big in kids' TV, didn't he? And he's, you know, because he's a little fellow with a sort of funny speaking voice. And then they put him into the studio. And I mean, I was just looking at his discography before we get onto specifics. You mentioned Splish Splash, which was his first hit. I mean, he had over his career 5 singles that charted.
Yeah.
And tons more that he put out.
Into the 70s, Super Punk. And
yes, that was a revelation.
Yeah. And Puck Wodgie.
Yeah, that was his last charting one in the early 70s. But yeah, Super Punk, it's like he starts out doing a cover of Splish Splash and he's doing Super Punk in the 1970s. So he, you know.
Look out! I wanna be a rotter in a punk rock band. A pin in me nose, don't you understand? I wanna be the biggest punk in the land. I hate you and I wanna be banned. Take it away, lad.
There's You Never Know as well, the one he did with Peter Gabriel.
Yes.
And Phil Collins. And he mixed in good circles.
Indeed, yeah. So I suppose let's get to the actual, the ones we've selected. And the one you've sort of suggested is perhaps representative of the concept of novelty is his cover of Bobby Darin's Splish Splash.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath long about Saturday night. Just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I sit down at the top and put my feet on the floor. I wrap the towel around me and I open up the door. And in a splish splash, I jump back in the bath. Well, I was, I don't know, there was a party going on.
He's belting that out. You've got sort of George Martin and all the lab boys at Parlophone sort of chipping in with plug hole noises and a little bit of silliness, but essentially, it is him covering a Bobby Darin rock and roll song. You know, there's not much that's comedic about it, but I think that's the novelty element, that it's a song about taking a bath. It's, you know, it's silly, but not funny.
Yeah, it was interesting to find out that obviously when you think of Bobby Darin doing it, you know, this is the guy who was Dream Lover and Beyond the Sea and stuff. Even Bobby Darin doing a song called Splish Splash, which he wrote or co-wrote.
Yeah.
You know, he's what I liked was it was Murray Decay, the disc jockey, who challenged him to write a song. Write a song. Did he actually ask him to write a song about being in the bath, or was it just write a song about something different?
Yeah, and it's him that also has the joint credit with Bobby Darin, so it's a great little, you know, knocking it off.
A skill of Murray the K to insert himself into pop sensations worlds.
Yeah, certainly, if you're getting 50% of the royalties with it, you know. Not bad.
Yeah, like you say, Splish Splash comes across almost like a straight cover, save for 5 or 10 seconds at the start, but even the Bobby Darin one has some sound effects on it. I mean, it doesn't have Bobby Darin doing the, oh, I'm going to have a bath bit at the start, which would have been good if he did.
Here we are then, just have a nice quiet bath now. Make me feel good. Test the water. Oh, lovely.
I think also George Martin, you mentioned, I think that's kind of the, you can see why the Beatles would warm to him when you're doing things like Yellow Submarine. George Martin spent a decade perfecting those noises, those sound effects. You know, if the Beatles come in and said, you know, what we want, right, is we want it to sound like, and they you know, he could come up with it. You know, if you want the sound of a submarine, yeah, there you go. Octopus's Garden, yeah, no problem. I'll make the sound of an octopus's garden. And it was all things like, I think of the Spring Song with Joan Sims. And
okay, the next time I come round here, I'm bringing my grand's air cushion. Oh, shut up.
He must have had great fun in the lab, you know, just hitting, banging things and you know, tape loops and splicing like he did with the Beatles. It's all there in those early comedy and novelty songs he did.
Definitely, it is, and it's also that wonderful contrast between his image as the very straight, upper class, even though he wasn't really, guy, you know, in this shirt and tie, but he's doing all this absolutely, I hesitate to use the word, but I'm going to use it, zany sound effects and sound design almost with a lot of these things.
Yeah, I think he was almost given the Beatles because EMI didn't know what to do with them. They just, oh, give him to George, give him to the guy that does the silly songs, you know.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting way that he ends up with them and what he does with them. And absolutely, it's his skill with these sorts of artists that feeds into a lot of that. I did find something very interesting. I did a little bit of research in the newspaper archive, see if I could find anything about Charlie Drake's Splish Splash.
Yeah.
And I found a little thing in the Daily Mail from the 2nd of September 1958, so not long after the record gets in the charts. But it gets up to number 7 in the charts.
Yeah.
And that's quite good. Parlophone R4461 for collectors.
And even it was a bigger hit in the UK than Bobby Darin's, which I don't think got quite as high as Charlie Drake's.
Yeah, so Mr. Drake himself says, and this is quoted in this newspaper article, "I was going to make a funny of Splish Splash, you know. Then George Martin, the recording manager, thought it would be a good wheeze to do it straight. So I did, and here we are with a hit. Isn't that a gasser?"
Isn't it great that people used to speak like that?
Yeah. Well, that's how it went through the filter to the Daily Mail anyway.
But, yeah.
So they're talking about the fact that they expected him to make a comedy record and he actually makes essentially a straight rock and roller.
Yes. Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. It's definitely a gasser.
I mean, in terms of what George Martin does with the arrangement, he doesn't do masses of it. It's accompaniment by Ken Jones. Although I do think sort of towards the end, he's got some really interesting rhythmical stuff going on. Lots of almost sounds like someone doing something on the spoons in the background. There's a lot of stuff. It's quite fun anyway when you do a bit of close listening to that one. But anyway, that's Charlie Drake with Splish Splash's first hit. And then you proposed representative via the medium of Charlie Drake to represent sort of out-and-out comedy.
The medium of Charlie Drake, yes.
Yeah, well, channeling through Charlie Drake as our conduit to this is... Mr. Custer, which again is another cover, isn't it?
I was having this online debate trying to track down. It was credited in two ways, but it's actually the same people just using aliases.
Took me ages to find that out. Yeah, Mr. Custer, I think that's probably the first sort of comedy song he did. And I was just listening now to Glowworm, which was the B-side. But it's kind of like he copies that formula, you know, the downtrodden, you know, person trying to get out of going into the battle, sort of a bit hopeless, a bit helpless.
Yeah.
And you see that again in, you know, it's that formula that his boomerang won't come back. He's bent his ass a guy. He's lost the end of his yodel. It's sort of a formula that him and Max Diamond kind of worked up for endless singles, it seems like.
Yeah, he does have a very much a, yeah, oh no, it's happened to me type character, and it comes across very much in Mr. Custer, which, although yeah. I went and listened to the original Mr. Custer, he does this as a, although it's a comedy song, he does it as a quite a straight cover of that other version as well, though.
Again, it's the George Martin influence, isn't it, that kind of, I think, turns it into something else. You've got all the sound effects coming in, you've got silly voices, you've got shrieking, you know, you've got hooves, explosions, and George Martin is throwing everything at it, isn't it? But the silly excuses that he comes up with for not going into battle, like he needs to return his library book, which aren't there in the original. He said, you know, he takes it and runs with it. I think that's probably the first comedy, I would say, single, as opposed to novelty.
Mr. Custer, may I be excused for the rest of the afternoon, please? Want to change my library book. Oi, Wyatt, duck your head! Ooh. Bit late on that one, son. God, I bet that don't half hurt.
They were sure of victory, the men of the 7th Cavalry, as they rode on.
There's an inherently funny thing about when Charlie Drake uses his own voice to do the little narrative bits in these things, because he has got a very unique and distinct voice. Which one thing I did find as I was flicking through a few different examples of his stuff is he does one off the back of the James Bond craze.
Oh yeah, that's almost all spoken as well. That's the Charlie Drake 007, isn't it? The one of my favourite Charlie Drake tracks is the B side of that, Bumpanology, which I think I've put on when I do my compilation CDs. I still do them each year. But Bumpanology, which is the B side, is a really good song. It's again, is it comedy? Is it novelty? It's just about him bumping his head. It's ludicrous. But again, sung really well, produced really well. It's Johnny Pearson accompaniment and George Martin, again, sort of fitting it in between the Beatles by that stage. Yeah. But yeah, great B-side.
I used to play piano in a local bar until I bought a 12-string electric guitar. When I plugged it in, threw me over the place. I did the dog and the shake and finished flat on my face. I know the mommy.
I was amazed with Charles Drake 007. It was that it was all spoken word, and it did have a joke in it, which, because I've never heard it before, I listened to it today. It had a joke in it about a gun silencer, which made me laugh really, really loudly. Yeah. It's excellent timing. And to do that on record is quite a skill, really. Yeah, so we've got Splish Splash on one hand, and we've got something like Mr. Custer on the other. So how do you think sort of novelty and comedy plays out then in terms of the records people are putting out? What does one have precedent over the other, really? I mean, I will say and remind everyone, the reason I call this podcast a novelty songs podcast is I'm using it in a bit of a sneaky way, a sort of a catch-all term for meaning something new, something different.
Yeah.
So one of my opinions about novelty is a novelty song doesn't necessarily have to be funny.
No.
It just has to be unusual or unique or can stand out. Whereas obviously a comedy song or comedy record, you know. So, yeah, I'm just wondering what you're thinking about that.
That's sort of the essence of it, is you need to make someone laugh. There needs to be a joke. But it's sort of people just lump them all in together. And I think a lot of it, I blame people like Ken Dodd, really, for Muddy in the Waters, because for all of his success in the 60s, and he's up there, sort of top 10 best-selling artists of all time, obviously as a crooner, he does his Diddy Men records, which are they comedy? It's more sort of, they're aimed at children, more sort of novelty, I would say, than, you know, than comedy. There's not much jokes. Yeah, and people like Dick Emery did an album in the 60s, and he had a sort of chart hit. And it, I always think it's a shame that, you know, that they didn't do more records, really. Dick Henry later did Comedy Record. You know, if you saw Ken Dodd on telly on doing Top of the Pops and hitting number one, you think, I can do that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
Blame Ken Dodd for it.
Well, he's not around to argue back now anymore. But
no.
Yeah, it is an interesting one because he was a massively successful crooner, but it was almost like that side of his world had nothing necessarily to do with the comedy side of his world, although I believe he did close shows with, you know, he'd do a number in his shows, wouldn't he, and things like that.
Yeah, no, his act was kind of a lot of comedy, but broken up with his songs. And he was almost like a one-man package tour that, I think it was that variety bill. He was always trying to replicate that, where you would have, you know, a pianist come on, there'd be a juggler, there'd be, by which time everyone's going, oh, when's Ken Dodd coming on? And if you could sit through all of that for hours on end, well done. But I think what you said something earlier, actually, about all the comedians that released things back in the day. One of the odd things I find is the number of comedians that didn't.
Oh, right.
You would think, say, the Carry Ons. Kenneth Williams did a lot of records on his own and as Ramblin' Sid Rumpo, and even on Into the Will-O-The-Wisp era. But someone like Sid James, who you thought, you know, with all his catchphrases and things, releases a couple of records. It's very strange, you know. All those comedians, they had the catchphrases, they had the familiar routines, they had mass appeal through things like the Carry On films. But you think of all the actors, comedians that didn't release records, I always find that extraordinary as well. Now, Leslie Phillips, you would have thought, high to your fame in the 60s, why not do a song called Ding Dong?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not? You know, got to be worth a go. Up the charts, you know, you don't even have to sing. You can just, yeah, hello, you know, ding dong. That's it. Stick an instrumentation on the background. You'd be fine.
Charlie Drake, obviously, on the B-side of Splish Splash, had his catchphrase song with the Hello, My Darlings.
Hello, my darlings, yes.
The whole damn world is yours and mine. Sing hello, sing hello, sing hello. Hello, my darlings.
I've had enough of this. I'm going on the other side to have a bath.
Yeah, it is interesting. But then I think after we come out of the 60s, we start to get very much a sort of the dominating of what you'd probably call novelty over comedy more, don't we? And I suppose, is it the 1980s? Is that the golden era of the massive novelty hit?
Well, I was born in December 1971 when Benny Hill was number one. And you think, okay, that's a comedy record. It's a story. There was a video. There's a narrative. Some good gags in there. Great comedy song. But you think forward to 1975 and you've got Windsor Davis and Don Estelle essentially doing... Don Estelle could sing really well for all his faults. I mean, he was a mad, cantankerous... person, but you know, he sings really well. Windsor Davis is kind of chipping in, but I wouldn't say that's a comedy song. That's kind of the novelty. But I know what you mean. The novelty, I would think, is more things like Black Lace and Timmy Mallett with Bon Ballerina, you know, just doing songs frothy and amusing, the novelty. But I wouldn't say there's any comedy involved in them.
Yeah, they're not necessarily designed to make you laugh. Because, you know, although we perceive them as being funny because they're unusual or they contain elements that you wouldn't expect in a song in the charts, they're not necessarily designed deliberately to make you laugh. Mm. Timmy Mallett covering Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, he wasn't saying, I'm going to do this to be funny. It was, this supposedly suits my character as I'm seen on, you know, morning television at the moment. And... so it's novelty rather than comedy, even though we might find it funny from the outside.
Yeah, which makes me wonder why Leslie Phillips didn't release a record called Ding Dong, or Sid James do a record called Cor Blimey or something like that, you know.
Leslie Phillips is still with us, isn't he?
Well, yes, and if I win the lottery, I shall drag his 93-year-old body into a recording studio. And
finally get Ding Dong.
Yeah, I'm sure the world will thank me for that.
If push came to shove... and someone ran into your house and demanded this of you, could you confidently divide your record collection up into a pile of novelty and a pile of comedy?
Well, I could probably do it, but there'd be ones that you'd have to debate. I mean, the Ken Dodd example is the song of the Diddy Men a novelty or a comedy. It's mainly just Ken Dodd with a speeded up voice going, you know, we are the Diddy Men, we come from Naughty Ash. Is that funny? Do you? Humour is a very subjective thing. Probably some people find Ken Dodd speeded up singing about jam butty mines probably the height of hilarity. But I, you know, it's a record. I think he's aimed it squarely at children. He's got bored of raking in the millions from Love Is Like a Violin. You know, I'd say that would be a novelty record. But we could sit here. I've got thousands of them. You must come round. We'll have a debate one day.
Yes. So how many do you have? Have you got a running count of records?
I think I've probably got about 2,000 albums. Yeah. And I don't know how many singles. The singles live upstairs. So I'm faced every day over lockdown staring at the albums. You've got about 1,000 7-inch singles.
Wow.
Probably around that month. And there's the joy of just finding new things. You know, I think because people only know sort of, say, like 10 comedy albums, the ones you see all the time in charity shops, you know, those first few Hancocks.
Yeah.
That people just assume, oh, you must have them. You know, you've got the two Ronnies and you've got Hancock. That must be all the comedy albums in the world, isn't it? But, you know, every month, you know, finding new things. And like the album today that I posted on Twitter, Humpty Dumpty with Keith Harrison Orville. I didn't know that existed until last week. There it is.
Come on, Orville. It's bedtime.
Will you read me a nursery rhyme? You know, the one about the big egg.
Oh, you mean Humpty Dumpty? Well, all right then, as long as you promise to go to sleep.
Orville, close your eyes. We will open up the skies and guide you to a place where you can dream.
Yes, it's a constant journey of discovery. And, you know, when I look at things like my want list and it's running into that's 1,500 things on the want list. You know, I'm never going to be able to afford to buy all of them, but I like to sort of keep track of them. I've got quite a good photographic memory. So I can, if I'm in a shop, normally I can remember if I own something. Singles, slightly less so. But
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the thing with these comedy albums, and whether they're comedy albums or they contain novelty songs, whatever way you want to slice it, is that it's all been happening alongside, mixed in with pop and rock and prog and punk and everything else as well. So it's like you could strip out everything that people would name for what music is for the last 50, 60 years, and you'd still have hundreds of thousands of songs from a whole other set of artists that people perhaps don't realise were there at the time. And if you've ever listened to Sounds of the 60s on Radio 2, sometimes you can listen to that and you can be thinking, do you know what, the 60s wasn't all gold, because so much of what was filling the charts up was from people who had quick hits or little novelty numbers and were there and then gone again, or were actors whose legacy doesn't live on in the musical world.
It's always fascinating when you look at charts from that period, just how diverse things were. I mean, that goes through right into the 80s from the 50s, but you would have just so many disparate acts. You'd have the old guard, you'd have the new guard, you'd have those novelty hits, you'd have, you know, songs by actors in there. Just such a mixture, which, looking at the charts now, just doesn't exist anymore. It's mainly downloads, so it's mainly young people buying R&B now. But just the number of things in the charts are extraordinary. And going back to Splish Splash, a lot of those early charts where you get two or three different versions of the same song in the charts at the same time.
Yeah.
Someone would have hit in America, they try and rush it over here and have a hit here before it was released. You know, even the likes of Dionne Warwick with those Burt Bacharach songs.
Yes, absolutely.
There was that competition going on with Dusty Springfield to see who could have the hit first, who can rush it out the quickest, you know. But you'll have both of those songs in the charts. And, you know, your mum will send you out to buy one and you get the wrong one.
Yeah, that's where obviously the rise of the songwriter performer is obviously very important, because if you're putting out your own stuff, you're not going to be in competition with anyone. So yeah. I suppose that's what really emerges in the 60s more than any time before. Yeah. So, I mean, Charlie Drake, have you got an absolute favourite Charlie Drake number?
I think it might have to be My Boomerang Won't Come Back. Just, yeah, George Martin's on form. The Aborigine noises and the not authentic Aborigine noises, but it'll do, you know, if you're in Abbey Road, it's the nearest you're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly did well with the things he had to hand to actually create that soundscape.
Mind you, I did say Bumpinology earlier, didn't I? Ah, Bumpinology. I've changed my mind. My favourite is Bumpinology.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, you know, I think we can allow you My Boomerang Won't Come Back by default as being the sort of the big hit for Charlie Drake, certainly in Australia where it got to number one.
Yeah, it was a hit in America as well, which seems bizarre. But I mean, it was number 21 in the US charts, but that's before the Beatles got to America. You know, and everyone thinks the Beatles were the first act to break America. I mean, Acca Bilk was there before anyone, but yeah, Charlie Drake at number 21.
Yeah, indeed. That's a strange thing to comprehend, that perhaps kids were going to a high school hop in 1961 and somewhere in the DJ's case of stuff that they brought with them was My Boomerang Won't Come Back by Charlie Drake.
Yeah, I like to think they did.
Yeah. I think perhaps a lot of some of the things that Charlie Drake did are perhaps mired now a little bit in what you'd call cultural appropriation now, or mockery, maybe.
Sort of racially insensitive.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Yes, I think probably My Boomerang Won't Come Back more than anyone. But at its heart, though, you know, it's a piece of whimsy, isn't it? It's silly. It's that formula, you know, the Assegai one when he's chatting with the Zulus and the yodel where he's off in Switzerland. And yeah, I'm too heavy for the Night Brigade. That's another reworking of that formula.
But, you know, by and large, it's interesting and entertaining, whether you want to call it novelty or whether you want to call it comedy or whether you want to just call it, in the case of Charlie Drake, straightforward pop and rock.
Yeah, I think especially things like Splish Splash, very good. It's very good rock. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of it. I don't think Dick Henry really did much. He did a crooning, is it? Dick Emery had a hit with If You Love Her. Says that he was in Australia when it became a hit, so he couldn't do the Top of the Pops thing. But that was 1969, and that was a chart hit. But that was very much his crooning days. And that album, that was quite early on in my record hunting days, the Dick Emery one.
Oh, right.
But yeah, he does loads of those records that are quite similar. You know, it's all crooning and You're Just as Lovely Today. And
is it sort of mainly standards and things like that?
Don't think there were cover versions, probably written for him, but it took sort of 4 or 5 years before he starts doing things like You Are Awful But I Like You.
Oh, you are awful, but I like you.
Come on and do the conga, listen to my song. You can sing along and dance the night away.
You know, the catchphrase, and it's... and that, again, I think that's... I don't have a copy, but that was a hit in Australia. There's a Spanish release, there's a German release. And again, that thing I was saying about just the nice picture sleeve, and I've not got around to buying one, but I always wonder what they must have made of it. You know, if you're Italian, you can understand just enough English to get by. How you relate to things like I Am a Cider Drinker by the Wurzels, or You Are Awful But I Like You by Dick Emery.
Yes.
I used to could speak German and French quite well, but you know, I would struggle with I'm a cider drinker. It's odd.
And whether they then think that that represents what a massive part of the, you know, the English population's like. Is it representative of anyone who lives in the countryside to an Italian who's heard I am a cider drinker?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they have spot cider in France, but...
Indeed. Right, well, I think we'll bring this to a close then. I mean, the simple fact is it's quite hard to have a debate about what's comedy and novelty because the size of the overlap is huge, really, isn't it?
If you say, if I make a statement like I collect comedy records, that's like saying I collect jazz. Now, you've got, like, so many different styles of jazz. You could collect, say, just Scandinavian jazz or just Norwegian jazz. You could collect bebop. You could collect, you know, New Orleans. But I've just said, right, comedy, that's it. And there are records, to be honest. People are always amazed that have you got a record player. I mean, they know I buy records, but they will still say things. Oh, do you actually listen to them? Think about what people, you know, if I was just buying them and, you know, sealing them and never playing them, it'd be a bit pointless, really.
Yeah.
It's that thing that I will always listen to a record once. That's what I say. You know, that I will play them and I think, right, well, that's, I'm never listening to that again. That was unfunny. It was laboured. It was dreadful. That's going in the shelf. But I'm glad I've got it. As a record of an act at a time, at a place. For instance, I went to Belfast for work. There was, where I was based, there was a great record shop just around the corner. And that introduced me to loads of Northern Irish comics that I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could just concentrate on buying Irish comedy records. But, yeah, it's this sort of goal I've set of just, you know, if it's British, if it's comedy slash novelty, even like showbiz, which I think is another sort of genre.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
You know, like the Ian McShane album that I posted on Twitter the other day. It's neither novelty nor comedy. It's dreadful, but I've got a copy just because, you know. But a lot of the stars that did records, that David Hemmings album that I keep seeing, it's just always a bit too much. It's like, I've seen it in shops before and it's like 40 quid, but, you know, you can't really justify it when I've got to eat and go out every now and then. But, yeah.
Man cannot live on Hemmings alone.
Sadly, no.
Have you got an absolute favourite? Is there anything that you return to most often when you're listening, though?
There are certain albums I really like. One Man's Meat by the Baron Knights. I swear that's the, well, saying that it's the best thing they've ever done. But it's not comedy. It's not even novelty. It's just, they went through a phase in the early 70s of just trying to be really serious musicians. And they got so good at playing different styles and mimicking other rock and roll pop acts that they are very, very, or were very, very good musicians. One Man's Meat by the Baron Knights, I do really love that, but it's not even a comedy record, really.
Oh, that's interesting.
We have a record club here in Glossop. We sort of take it in turns, each of us, to do a theme. And I did do a comedy record night. I chose Benny Hill, his Benny Hill Sings album, which I think from being born when he was number one, especially the 60s stuff he did, which is a bit more subtle, great production, I think. Tony Hatch has got his finger in a few of those. Very good songs and very funny and well-written. I also chose, I think it was Sunday Afternoon at Home, the Hancock's Half Hour.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Side, which, you know, I could listen to those Hancocks endlessly. Just, you know, a man at the height of his powers. Just, you talk about timing, you know, Hancock was at his peak before the cue cards came in. You know, he was a master of delivery.
Yes, they're almost like music in themselves, aren't they, because of the ebb and flow of the scripts and his ability to deliver them are excellent.
And the lines that Galton and Simpson would chuck in there, you know, just throwaway lines that, you know, when he's complaining about the gravy and he's saying,
I thought my mother was a bad cook, but at least her gravy used to move about.
Yeah, marvellous dialogue and great characters, great actors. Yeah, I think it would veer between Hancock, Benny Hill, Baron Knights. There's many that I would return to.
And be honest, how often do you find Charlie Drake on your turntable?
Not that often, really. I mean, he only does one album, and that's a collection of all the singles. B-sides and singles, it would mean going through, rooting through the singles box, which I'm more, just because I think I sit downstairs and the singles aren't alphabetized, whereas the albums are. So I'm thinking I'll kind of play more albums than I do singles.
Mm.
If you wanted to dig out a specific Charlie Drake, yeah, that's going to be me sitting upstairs for about an hour trying to root through them and find them.
Fair enough, then. I think that tells us all we need to know about how often he pops out on there anyway to be re-listened to. So with that, then, I will bring this to a close and I'll let you go upstairs to your singles and start rooting through for your copy of 1966's Don't Trim My Wick, backed with Birds.
I might just go down the pub and see if it's on the jukebox. I think that'd be easier.
Good luck with that. Yeah. And thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.